This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
And I'm Duane DeFreitas.
And the two of us are flying, not solo,
duo
tonight, as our good buddy Tosin is overseas. So we'll see him hopefully next week back on the show.
He's in the wilds of Japan, Nippon.
Yes, yes. And I can't wait to see. Hopefully he brings back lots of pictures and lots of cool experiences. Maybe something tech-related that he could share with us on the show.
I don't know if you can find anything tech-related in Japan.
Oh, that's impossible. Yeah. It's completely... They're completely out of touch with technology in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, this week we're going to talk about Google buying Into Music and shutting down their oldest social network, Yahoo as well. Did T-Mobile swindle customers out of millions of hidden fees? Facebook's secret mood manipulation study? And is the NSA's first transparency report just one big oxymoron? As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com and leaving us a review. You can also find our subscription links in our show notes. You can join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. And write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Our show's also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. So let's just jump right into the hottest stories of the week here. Starting with Google announcing on Tuesday that it had bought Songza, which is a 3-year-old app that competes with Pandora and others in making customized playlists of recommended songs for a rumored $39 million. Acquiring Songza could help Google improve its ability to offer music curation, which is the generating of playlists of songs tailored to each user. This is similar to Apple's recently purchased Beats music service. Beats basically does the same thing. One of their aspects is that they have that sort of music curation service as well. Google said that they're not planning on any immediate changes to Songza, but they're going to begin to incorporate the service into the company's existing services like Google Play Music or even YouTube.
Yeah, this is an interesting buy for a lot of reasons. We already talked about the kind of quadrifecta of music subscription services right now. You've got Google, and Google Music allows you to, four pillars are usually – can you buy music? Yeah, there's a music store. Can you upload your music? Yeah, Google Music allows you to do that. Apple has iTunes Match. Amazon has Cloud Player, or it used to be Cloud Player, Amazon Music. And all three of those guys have stores. Then you've got some of the other things around there, like can you build kind of a radio station? And that's been Pandora's wheelhouse for a long time. And Apple moved into it with their iTunes Radio, and Google had already moved into it with their Google Music offering. And then finally, in that digital music storage, digital music streaming area, the fourth pillar is typically the ability to kind of go out, find any track in the catalog that the vendor has. So the Amazon catalog, Amazon doesn't have this yet, but the iOS catalog, iTunes catalog, the Google catalog, or most popularly, the Spotify catalog or RDO catalogs. So these guys have, tens of millions of songs. They've hooked up with all the big guys, the big, record labels and the indie guys in order to allow people who are paying this monthly fee to pull songs, download playlists, create playlists, all this stuff. So that's the quadrifecta. But what we haven't seen is this fifth pillar, which is curation, dynamic playlist creation. And this is to say, when you look at Pandora, they will take, that you think, oh, dynamic playlist creation, Pandora already has that. And it's true. On some level, they do. In the kind of a 2006 level, they do. They can take an artist they can take a song or they can take a genre and they can make a playlist for you, and they'll call it a radio station, which works for lots of people.
Yeah. Spotify as well.
What?
Spotify as well.
Spotify can do that as well, yeah. What Beats and Songs do that's different is that on the fly, they will create a hyper-targeted playlist for your mood, your activity, whatever. Beats does this, we talked about, with what they call the sentence. It's Friday, I'm walking my dog, and I'm excited. And Beats will find music that suits that, and it'll dynamically generate a playlist that suits that mood, that human understanding of the world. Songs has been doing it for even longer than Beats. Rather than just having a series of algorithms that pulls that together, Songs does that with humans. So they've got human music curators. It's a process that's been built over a long time. The original Songs was actually bought by Amazon, and then the guys behind it got to use the name Songs again for this new site, new service. Mm-hmm. And it's been on the web for a while. And what they allow you to do is basically they have default curated stuff. So if you look at Songs, it'll say like walking home, walking my dog, going to a party, cleaning up the house. This is a playlist that their music experts have created specifically for users in these tasks. And what Google is doing by buying them is they're going to allow people to hop in there and kind of make these hyper-targeted playlists for whatever mood or activity they're about to start or do and jump in there. This is a cool thing because one of the things is, as a geek, I always hear people say, I don't understand why everybody's not on Spotify. And I get it. People love Spotify because of all the choices, all the customization, all the bits and pieces. But there is a pervasive amount of people that are not that inside baseball about music. These are people who, in many ways, they still listen to the radio. In many ways, they just kind of want this to be figured out for them. So these are the people who hop on Pandora, and then they find something like Songza, and they're pretty excited that it could be that specific, yet that not, you know, without so much, I guess, coordination or like fixing up or like having to like set it up. So this way, people are allowed to kind of set it and forget it. It actually kind of approaches that satellite radio space where you have like 1,000 channels of something. And this is kind of what Songza does, what Beats does. And frankly, I think this is the future of mass market streaming audio. The idea that you don't have to go in and find and make a playlist over 2 hours or 3 hours or 5 days. Instead, you can just ask for something and it's going to put it together for you based on what you want, based on what you're doing. Ephemeral.
I think this is a terrific move for Google. And I'm wondering, you know, you're talking about the different pillars of streaming music services. I'm wondering if this sets the tone for all the other services, if now everyone else is going to want to have some sort of music curation service. In particular, like because I'm a Spotify subscriber, I'm looking at Spotify, and they have something called Genres and Moods, and it lets you sort of pick a playlist based on either a genre or a mood, you know, focus or relax. But the playlists within there are still pre-picked. They're not they can't be generated on the fly like what Songza and Beats Music does.
Right, right. I mean, like Songza has a lot of pre-picked stuff. Beats Music is one of the few that really tries to generate it on the fly. But Songza, you know, I just popped open my Songza. Watching the sunset is an option. Looking fresh in the 90s. Working out. Summer break. So these are very nuanced moods, right? These are very nuanced pieces. They call that the concierge piece. Then they have a specific mood piece where it's like angsty, aggressive, campy, celebratory. That's more of what I see on Spotify. What Songs is trying to do is just kind of approach this from a human perspective, kind of back in to what it is you want rather than just having you figure out what you want with respect to the computer. We all know the computer knows all the artists. Pandora's Music Genome Project is very successful because the computer breaks down what's specific about the song and then it tries to find other songs that are like that. And they're good at that. Pandora's good at that. I don't know if Pandora's going to jump into this space. I can see Spotify trying to because they want to be all things to all people.
Yeah.
Just like Google Music, just like Amazon. Not Amazon. Just like Google Music, just like iTunes. Amazon Music is moving in this direction, but it's doing it incredibly slowly and deliberately. The Bezos scheme there seems to be, what can I offer my Prime users at no additional cost or at minimal additional cost? Rather than go out and build a whole service myself and then try to get people that way. He wants to incrementally add people to Prime, and he's doing it through following these services. So he's not quite there yet. But I can totally see Spotify wanting to add to this. And Google Music has, I know, already taken away some of my music file friends from Spotify.
Really?
Yeah, I brought them over there. Now, other of my friends who are hardcore into music say that the Google Music community is like a graveyard. There's just not a lot of people there. Songs that has more than 5 million people by now, in mid-2013 they had 4.7 million. They've been growing steadily. So I have a feeling that part of this is also getting that user base to be excited about the functionality. It's unclear whether Google's just going to roll this into Google Music or Songs is going to remain independent for a long time. It's independent right now. We'll see. I mean, Apple left Beats on its own for the time being. We'll see what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, they did say that they were going to incorporate it into their services, which is exciting to me. I mean, one or the other, the having it improve Google's already existing services is a plus.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that you can go to one place and have a one-stop shop for these like new, like these five pillars, these five tiers of music streaming, these five types of music streaming, that's obviously a plus. But you have to – what they're doing is they're drawing in the music buyers. They're drawing in the Pandora people who just want streaming. They're drawing in these hyper-targeted people. And they're drawing in the sort of like, you know, classic Spotify. It's all about – me choosing my music, me choosing my playlist. They're doing all that on one system and in one interface. And the interface is actually not very complicated, which is good. Apple's doing the same thing with their music app. So I think it's a key piece for anyone who wants to have a comprehensive streaming music offering. And I got to say, despite the fact that radio still has the vast majority of music exploration going on, I think they have to begin to worry based on the ubiquity of cell phones, these services, and the fact that companies like T-Mobile are now saying, hey, if you're streaming music, that's not part of your data plan.
Right.
Every single car coming out in the next couple of years is going to have, you know, a higher likelihood of having Bluetooth connectivity. And if they don't have Bluetooth connectivity, if you go for something higher end, you'll get Apple's connectivity or Google's connectivity. So radio really has to worry somewhat because you can now walk into your car. I walk into my car and it automatically starts playing whatever's on my phone through Bluetooth. But in the future, if I have Google in the car, like Android, you know, Auto or Apple in the car, iOS in the car or whatever. I'm never going to think about using the radio. It's just going to be an option right there in my dash.
Radio is already gone for me in my mind. Other than the occasional public radio, NPR.
Yeah, even now with National Public Radio or, you know, local public radio, that typically happens via their podcast or streaming via TuneIn or something like that.
Yeah.
TuneIn is already showing up in cars. So there is a lot of content that's phasing out traditional radio. And if you remember when TV's traditional, you know, airwaves kind of got phased out with the introduction of HDTV, people were pretty upset, but music seems to be moving much more smoothly. Audio seems to be moving much more smoothly into this digital space because of the kinds of options that Google, Apple, and others are bringing to the table.
Yep. Well, Google giveth and Google taketh away. They announced this week that they're shutting down their first social network, Orkut, on September 30th.
Brazilians around the world are going to be sad.
Just in time for the
World Cup.
Yeah, so they'll have one less service to talk. Well, it won't be till September 30th, so they can still chat on Orkut until then. Orkut launched in 2004 and was named after Google engineer Orkut Büyükkötten, who created it. As you mentioned, is very popular in Brazil for years it was the leading social network. Facebook finally surpassed that in January 2012. The engineering director of Orkut, Paulo Golgar, that name sounds Brazilian, fittingly, says, "It's been a great 10 years and we apologize to those still actively using the service. We hope people will find other online communities and spark more conversations and build even more connections for the next decade and beyond. Orkut users will be able to continue to use the network till September 30th, but no new accounts can be created starting this week. Orkut profile data, community posts, and photos can be exported with Google Takeout," which is good. I'm glad they're still allowing that.
Yeah, people want to be able to take their data and their experiences with them. But frankly, once you download all that stuff, what are you going to do with it? So much of that content is about the community around it.
That's a good
question. I guess if they have a good export tool and viewing tool, you can kind of maybe view it all as one big stream. But it's sad when these things go away. I mean, not everything lasts forever. Orkut came out during a time of a lot of movement in the social networking space.
Sure.
And you know, Facebook with its real names and ties to your actual human networks really ate up the world, the social networking world. And it's interesting to see that now, after basically, the last 10 years of social media, 11 years, that they're kind of the definer in the space. Even as we worry about some of the new – not worry. Even as Facebook worries or takes note of some of the new ways of communicating, purchasing things like Instagram and Snapchat to remain relevant, Orkut was really, you know, kind of not growing. And frankly, with Google's Plus initiative, it was stagnating and they weren't putting any more development into it. So unfortunately, it goes the way of Google Reader.
Did you ever have an Orkut account?
Yeah, I did.
I just never got on the Orkut train.
Well, I have some ties to Brazil, being in Freitas. And so I was like, oh, I'll hop on Orkut. I'll see what it's all about. And I got to say, I haven't been on it in years.
Yeah.
Because everybody moved to Facebook. And
sure.
Having had a Facebook account since 2003 or 2004, it's kind of been, you know, all I've used.
Google's not the only one shutting down services. Yahoo also is killing off a series of products, spring cleaning that they the starting extension of the spring cleaning that they started last year. They'll be closing smart email service Zobni, but they're going to be keeping some of those smart functions within their existing Yahoo Mail service.
Yeah, I saw that. Zobni is interesting because Zobni was its own thing, and then Yahoo picked it up. I remember it mostly as a plugin for Outlook, and that was an interesting experience given that it was designed to work with the native Outlook client. But yeah, I can see Zobni going the wayside, especially when you have, you know, things like you know, Google and Yahoo putting these smart features into their mail.
Yeah. What else? Also, New Look. Some of these I've never heard of before, which, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that they're sunsetting these. New Look, Research Reports, Bookmarks.yahoo. I think I've used Bookmarks.yahoo. But they said that bookmarking tool will be folded into Yahoo's toolbar, so that's nice.
Yahoo, I mean, they're simplifying their world.
Yeah.
You can't keep everything that you've been developing up and running indefinitely if it's not getting traction.
Right. And
smart
this kind of stuff.
These things down.
Yeah. Yahoo, Google, they sunset stuff all the time. You know, they'll fire up these programs and these services, and after a while, people don't use them. They either sunset them or they cannibalize them and take the best out of them and incorporate them into what they've already got going. So this kind of stuff happens all the time. All right, moving on here. T-Mobile made hundreds of millions of dollars by allowing known scammers to bill consumers with fraudulent unauthorized charges for for text messaging service, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, alleged on Tuesday. They charged them with they filed a complaint against T-Mobile, accusing it of knowingly profiting from the practice of allowing bogus charges to be placed on their subscribers' bills. T-Mobile CEO John Legere called the FTC's complaint unfounded and without merit, saying that T-Mobile stopped billing for these premium SMS services last year and launched a proactive program to provide full refunds for any consumer that feels they were charged for something they didn't want. FTC alleges that T-Mobile was collecting up to 40% of unauthorized charges for content such as horoscope or celebrity gossip. These charges typically cost about $10 a month for premium services and were buried in phone bills in such a way that it made it difficult for consumers to understand what they were paying for. Even after T-Mobile learned that some of the services were offered by scammers, the company continued to allow the charges, sometimes for years, according to the FTC. I have a feeling that this kind of thing is not uncommon and isn't just indigenous to T-Mobile.
Yeah, you know, I look at this, and to me the thing that was kind of most interesting was the fact that T-Mobile CEO came out and said, "We actually found this out instead of issuing refunds." That's huge. T-Mobile's done a lot to kind of sit around and say, "Hey, look, we are about the user. We are about what you guys want. We are about giving you everything you need." So this is the kind of thing that really, like, you know, puts a smudge on their current PR efforts with the, you know, free international roaming and the other things that they've got going for them. So this is going to be an interesting thing to watch. And on the one hand, it's nice to see the FTC do something to protect consumer interests. I think that it's important for them to go and take a fine-tooth comb to all of the various different
AT&T,
Verizon, Sprint, all these guys. Because everybody knows that when they look at these bills, especially the cable bills, it seems like it's not what's been advertised, and the taxes don't add up to these numbers. So, you know, it's definitely a good thing this is being looked at. I have a feeling that T-Mobile is gonna settle this.
Yeah. Now, I think the thing that I'm looking forward to most, being a AT&T subscriber myself, is this news being a wake up call for everyone to do a fine tooth comb on their own accounts and see what they're being charged with. Seeing this has inspired me to look at my AT&T. Account, see what they're charging me for as well. So who knows?
Yeah, it's key. I mean, people need to be aware of their stuff. Unfortunately, there's so much information people look at. I was just doing some research, and in order for a person to basically go out and just read the privacy policies of the top 10 social networks, that's 8 hours a day for about 30 days in terms of looking it up and defining all the words that aren't in normal speech and all that stuff. That's just the privacy policies of all the stuff that you do. That's free. Now, when you go into the billing of stuff that's not free, trying to figure out everything that's assigned in there, you know, you need a lawyer almost to figure all that stuff out. So as these services get more complex with their offerings, as they attempt to try to use different bits of data to do different things, and as they attempt to, you know, squeeze more profits, you just have to be vigilant about where your money's going and make sure that you don't end up with basically, you know, 500 little tiny charges that add up to the equivalent of one big charge.
Yeah, I think it's a very, very easy thing to fall into the trap of, for sure, because we sign up for something and it's a small charge, but all those little small charges add up. We don't even think about them because they're such a small charge and they occur on a regular basis that it's just out of sight, out of mind. I'm going to throw one last story before we take a break here, and that's something that just popped up on my radar in the last hour or two, and that is Paul Thurrott's supersite for Windows is claiming that a Microsoft smartwatch is coming. that they're going to be releasing a Samsung Gear Fit-like fitness band that'll display smartphone-based notifications. But they're going to be working with everything and not just the Microsoft's platform, not just Windows Phone, but it'll also work with Android, iPhone, and Windows Phone. So Microsoft is rumored to be coming out this fall with a fitness watch that will work on every platform.
It makes sense. One of the things I am hesitant about with the smartwatch revolution is that, you know, suppose Apple does come out with this iWatch. We've already seen from Google I.O. some of these Google Android Wear stuff. The idea that these things are just tied into their ecosystem is problematic from a watch owner's perspective.
Sure.
Because a watch should be relatively agnostic.
Yeah.
I do enjoy the Pebble. A lot of geeks have made fun of it. A lot of geeks love it. But one of the reasons why I like it so much is because it works well with both OSs, both mobile OSs. If Microsoft wants to jump into this space, they're going to have to expand to more than, frankly, to more than what we've seen with what Microsoft is doing on the mobile side. It's got to talk to everything. And that's the only way people are going to adopt it. If they can come out with an offering that is beautiful and functional, you know, they have a chance. They have a great chance. And especially if there's some added punch to using it with the Windows Phone software, Windows Phone devices, that will clearly work, take a watch and make it become a gateway into the purchase and use of Windows devices, much like the iPod was for the purchase and use of Apple devices back in the earlier part of this millennium.
Yep. Yep. Well, I'm looking forward to it one way or the other. I'm looking forward to competition in the marketplace amongst all of these iWatch devices.
Yeah, it's funny. You hear a lot of tech analysts that aren't financial analysts talking of, think about like a crowded marketplace.
Yeah.
But when you look at it, the marketplace is far from crowded. It's simply competitive. And, you know, competitive doesn't necessarily just mean Coke or Pepsi, Microsoft, Apple, you know, Android, iOS. Competitive often means, you know, in most markets, it means that you've got six or seven different options and the user has to go figure out which one's right for them. And frankly, that's as the best it can possibly be for the user. And one of the reasons why capitalism works, because you can have this this level of granularity. So one of the things I often worry about when I see a lot of these acquisitions is the fact that as things get snapped up by different companies, you end up with the Coke or Pepsi paradigm. But I'm much more happy with the, you know, contractors for my deck paradigm, where there's seven or eight different people that I have to, you know, look after, check out, whatever. And I'm hoping that the smartwatch space is going to be that space. The smartwatch space is going to have at least four to five separate things. Samsung with its Tenzin, the Android Wear stuff from multiple vendors, maybe something from Apple, and definitely offerings from Pebble. I'm looking for, and you know, in addition to maybe Jawbone gets in there, maybe Fitbit gets in there, you know. Let's see some real competition in this space. I know Garmin's already in there with their kind of legacy watches and their new Vivo Fit. So
I would just love to have some competition in the market space with my internet service provider. That would be a dream for me.
Yeah, that would be the best.
Maybe if Google Fiber came into my neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, you are in L.A. It could be that could be a thing.
All right, we're going to take a break here and talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the Audible book that I'd like to recommend this week is called Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era by James Barrett. This is frankly one of the most frightening and sober books that I've read in recent times. I just finished reading this book. It's basically about the rise of artificial intelligence and where it's going and where it potentially could be heading. AI puts the smart in your smartphone and pretty soon it's going to drive your car. It makes most of the trades on Wall Street, controls vital energy, water, and transportation infrastructure. In as little as a decade, AI could match and then surpass human intelligence. Once AI has done that, scientists argue, it'll have survival drives much like our own. We may be forced to compete with a rival more cunning, more powerful, and more alien than we can imagine. Our final invention explores the perils of the heedless pursuit of advanced AI. Until now, human intelligence has had no rival. Can we coexist with beings whose intelligence dwarfs our own? And will they allow us to? So this book was really sobering in its breakdown of how currently there are three types of artificial intelligence, both exist currently existing in theory and theoretical, and that is narrow AI, which is the sort of AI that is in your smartphone and will soon drive your car. There is artificial general intelligence, which is artificial intelligence that is at the same level of human intelligence. We have not—
Does that exist?
We have not achieved artificial general intelligence yet, but we're on our way to it. And then there's artificial super intelligence, which is, as the name suggests, a greater intelligence than human intelligence. And that is essentially that is, as the title suggests, our final— humankind's final invention, because it will improve itself and want to essentially want to fight for survival along with us. And it will be smarter than us, so it will outwit us, essentially. I don't think it's
I look at that and I think that, you know, I've got to read the book. I haven't read the book. I will say, I look at intelligence. I know knowledge is power. Intelligence is not necessarily power, right? There have been plenty of times where there's been a master who's smarter than his slave. There have been plenty of times when there's been a CEO who's got brilliant people working for him that are clearly much smarter than them. There could be super intelligence that we direct to do certain things. That doesn't mean it won't be our last invention. It's just that our invention will be the thing that's doing the inventing for us, anticipating our needs, doing whatever. There could be a place in which we have super intelligence that is part of our world and not destructive to our world. And I say that knowing full well that I look at things like— and I look at lots of different systems where there's a series of people who are in a kind of upper echelon, and there are people working for them that are getting things done, and oftentimes things need direction. Now, when I look at artificial intelligence that touches human intelligence, that second tier you talked about, part of me really believes that, you know, it's all about context, and it's all about the ability to kind of look at things, you know, being able to calculate things quickly, being able to do what my video game does, where it figures out where I am and has the different like modules try to come get me and get me. That's a cool level, but that context is something that I think isn't going to happen in just the software. It's going to happen when software meets hardware in a specific way. So, you know, robotics, that kind of thing. That's where I think we have to get worried.
Yeah. Well, the book goes into that in some sense. Also, that one of the goals of a superintelligence will probably need to be having some sort of human form, at the very least, to interface with our already existing environment, which is designed from the bottom up for humans. You know, our world is designed for us. So in order to control, have some sort of control in our world, it needs to take on a form like us. And this isn't just— I mean, this sounds sort of like pie in the sky speculation, but chances are, with all of the forces that are working towards artificial intelligence, this is likely to emerge within the next 10 years. So
the super intelligence, or the
at the very least, the general intelligence.
Okay,
an intelligence that is at the same level. But once we get to that point, we better start thinking about, curbing it, putting some safeguards on that sort of intelligence.
I mean, the three laws of robotics come to mind.
Yeah, yeah. And the first thing the book does, you really need to read this book, Duane. The first thing the book does is sort of dispel those concepts as basically they're created for literary drama, but they don't really work or exist in real application. So, but it's a fascinating book. It will change your mind about basically about how you feel about the future of artificial intelligence and the future and where we are going as a species. To download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. And using that URL helps us out on the show. Even if you don't like the service, you can cancel it and you still get to keep our final invention for free. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, Facebook secretly messes with your data again. So take a listen to this and come on back.
The humans are dead. The humans are dead. We used poisonous gases and we poisoned their asses.
Humans are dead.
The humans are dead.
They look like they're dead.
It had to be done.
I'll just confirm that they're dead.
So that we can have fun.
Affirmative. I poked one. It was dead.
Their system of oppression.
What did it lead to?
Global robo-depression.
Robots, robot people.
They had so much aggression that we just had to kill them and to shut their systems down. I said the humans are dead.
They are dead.
The humans are dead.
I noticed they're dead.
We used poisonous gases
with traces of lead.
And we poisoned their asses.
Actually, their lungs. Binary solo.
0000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000
on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas. For 1 week in January 2012, data scientists skewed what almost 700,000 Facebook users saw when they logged into its service. Some people were shown content with a preponderance of happy and positive words. Some were shown content analyzed as a sadder than average. And when the week was over, these manipulated users were more likely to post either especially positive or negative words themselves. This tinkering was just revealed as part of a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Many previous studies have used Facebook data to examine emotional contagion, as this one did. But this study is different because while other studies have observed Facebook user data, this one set out to manipulate it. They found that manipulating the news feeds displayed to the nearly 700,000 Facebook users, they could affect the content which those users posted to Facebook. More negative news feeds led to negative status messages. More positive news feeds led to positive statuses. As far as the study was concerned, this meant that it shown that emotional states can be transferred to others via emotional contagion, leading people to experience the same emotions without their awareness, without being aware of it. Facebook data scientist Adam Kramer said, "The reason we did the research is because we care about the emotional impact of Facebook and the people that use our product. We felt that it was important to investigate the common worry of seeing friends post positive content leads to people feeling negative or left out. At the same time, we're concerned that exposure to friends' negativity might lead to people to avoid using Facebook," obviously something that they don't want to do. He goes on to add, "In hindsight, the research benefits of the paper may not have justified all of this anxiety." So the people at Facebook don't understand exactly what all the
hubbub is about.
Yes, the hubbub. I mean, what they're doing is almost certainly legal in Facebook's terms of service. Users
is an interesting thing for me because okay. I've spent a significant portion of my life being an online marketer.
Yeah.
And split testing or A/B testing is a big piece of what you do with your users, especially when it comes to making use of your available data. For instance, there are plenty of services like Gilt or whatever where you may set up things, put them in your cart, and then you'll close the browser, walk away. Next time you log on, there'll be a discount, or you might receive an email in a day saying, hey, get back to your cart, we'll give you a discount.
Yeah.
That's an abandoned cart strategy. It's using the available data to say, well, will this person buy, based on their behavior, will they buy if we give them a discount? This was a big thing with that whole MoviePass technology that came out a couple years ago. The idea that you spend $30 a month and you get unlimited access to your local theater to watch movies. You know, I signed up, I didn't actually pay for it, I got a whole bunch of things. This is how companies use data to manipulate you into purchase, manipulate your behavior. They want to manipulate your behavior or see if they can manipulate your behavior to see if it can lead to, you know, greater profits. The era of big data, we were just talking about artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
A big piece of artificial intelligence is the use of massive amounts of data to understand behavior and to change it for the better or for whatever's profitable. And I think Facebook was doing that. They did not package the way the study was done well.
Yeah.
But let's face it, long have we understood that the fact that people are posting incredibly positive things about their lives, the edited version of their lives with all the happiness. Look, here's my view of the Flatirons in Boulder. Look, here's me in Tahiti. Look, here's me doing these things, yada, yada, yada. It causes an emotional response in others. And this was Facebook's way of trying to figure out what that emotional response was and how they could balance the newsfeed, which they've always balanced, which they've always tweaked. How can they balance that newsfeed to get the most user engagement? And if that means taking away some of the positive, taking away some of the negative, all the positive, all the negative, whatever, to see what they can get out of users, you know, I don't think that's a terrible thing. I don't know if this study needed to be published. A lot of these kinds of understandings are the kind, you know, they're metrics that are done internally. And I don't know. I look at this and I don't think this is on the Edward Snowden level of privacy breach that the current tech media is trying to make it out to be.
But do you think that they should have been more open about what they were doing? Like, Sheryl Sandberg, the CEO's number two executive, said that the study was poorly communicated, and for that communication, we apologize. We never meant to upset you. I mean, you know, the deal is basically that, people, they may already expect and be willing to have their behavior studied. They don't expect that Facebook will actively manipulate their environment in order to see how they'll react. That's a new level of experimentation. It turns Facebook from a fishbowl into a Petri dish. And that's apparently why people are flipping out about this.
Yeah, I mean, people are flipping out because the average person doesn't understand. Again, I was talking about how LinkedIn and all these other privacy policies, Facebook's privacy policy, the terms of use, that stuff is longer than the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights all put together.
Sure.
It's written in fairly reasonable language, you know, plain English, but it's hyper broad. It's hyper broad in what it allows the company to do. And because of that, people see the headlines and they freak out. Fact is, I don't think any of the users yet who went through this experiment know that they went through this experiment. Right.
And the data scientists themselves could not actually see the feed. Like, they didn't actually see individual users' personal feeds.
Right. It's a question of taking a unique user ID and making a decision about positive, negative, based on words that were in there.
Yeah.
And then seeing how that user reacts, post more or doesn't post more. Post more positive or post more negative. And that's a big piece of this. The privacy
was actually never breached in this thing. And the headlines don't talk about that. NBC Nightly News went into this in detail without ever mentioning the fact that this was anonymized, the fact that the privacy was never really breached, the fact that the people who were running this test never saw the kinds of posts. They just scanned them for words and said yes or no, repost. And that's what's interesting. So I feel like the news hasn't taken an in-depth look at this. What we know is that unique users were chosen, 700,000 of them about, and positive or negative was removed, and then they were studied to see if the reaction was one that elicited more posting or less posting, or more positive posting or less positive posting, more negative posting, less negative posting. It's not a crime. It's not, you know, it's not the big deal they think it is. It's a shame that Facebook wasn't better at packaging the story or isn't more transparent about how they use this data. But, you know, it's 2 years old. It happened a long time ago. Nobody remembers it. It's the social media in the internet age. I just think it's a far more drummed up story than it is a significant story.
Yeah, but you have to admit that with Facebook's long history of messing with people's data and not telling them about it, that
Facebook got a bad rap, but if you look at Facebook and how it treats data compared to some of its competitors, I guarantee you they've learned their lesson in ways that others have not.
But if they had truly learned their lesson, wouldn't they have
published the study.
Yeah. So, yeah, especially after the whole Beacon thing of in 2007, Facebook Beacon.
Yeah, I think that here's the thing. Facebook moves faster than society. When the news feed first came out, instead of you logging onto Facebook, seeing your profile, and then clicking through your friends to see what was up, when the news feed first came out, everybody was upset. Yeah. Everybody. I mean, you can go back to 2006 or 2007 when it happened. Everyone on Facebook, I hate this. It's invading my privacy. All my stuff is being published. All my stuff is being pushed. Yada, yada, yada. I hate it. The news feed is now the most important part of Facebook.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
When the news feed was changed, that it was more about who's more important to you than what just happened just now, more arguing, more upsetness. That's just how Facebook works. And granted, the press loves to have a field day with Facebook, which is why the press did not go out and say, oh, by the way, these things were done anonymously. Nobody saw whatever. They didn't focus on that. They focused on how long the privacy policy is. They focused on how nobody understands anything. They focused on how this was done and nobody was asked permission. They focused on the sensational bits because that's how the press makes their money. And that's, to me, the most disappointing part of this story. But yeah, Facebook should definitely be more, if they're going to publish these kinds of studies, they need to be more transparent. They need to put a better face on it, and they need to make sure that they publish them with straight up talking points. This is one of the things that tech has to do just generally. Tech needs to have better talking points in order to convince the public that the services and products that they're creating are necessary for their lives or can at least enhance them. And this is one of the things that we see when it comes to the way tech is dealt with in the media and in the government. They need to lobby more. Just one of those things.
Yep, I agree. So shame on you, Facebook. I mean, no one really got hurt, but it would have been better if we would have known a little bit more about what was going on. Speaking of large agencies and privacy and transparency, we haven't talked about the NSA in weeks. We've kind of cooled on them for a while, but they're back in the news again. Virtually no foreign government is off limits for the NSA, which has been authorized to intercept information, quote, concerning all but four countries, according to top secret documents leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. The United States has long had broad no spying arrangements with four countries, Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, the group collectively known as Five Eyes, along with the United States. But a classified 2010 legal certification and other documents indicate the NSA has been given a far more elastic authority than previously known one that allows it to intercept through U.S. companies not just the communications of its overseas targets, but any communications about its targets as well. The certification lists 193 countries that would be a valid interest for U.S. intelligence. And it permitted the agency to gather intelligence about entities, including the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the European Union, and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Yikes. So, I'm not really surprised to hear about that from the NSA. It's sort of par for the course from the stuff that we've been hearing about. What's interesting is that there is the group, the Five Eyes group, that they have that arrangement not to spy on, I think more than anything else. And last week, the NSA posted their first full transparency report. They posted it on, of all places, Tumblr.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice. I mean, Tumblr allows for easy reblogging.
Yeah.
Without kind of the limitations of Twitter, obviously, when it comes to the character counts and stuff. So I thought that was pretty forward facing for the NSA.
I didn't even know they had a Tumblr account, to be honest. So
it took me a while to realize that it was actually an official NSA Tumblr
account. Yeah.
And not someone just calling themselves the NSA.
Right, right. So their report breaks out the total number of orders for 2013. Broken out into FISA orders, NSA national security letters, and government requests for business records. They detail 38,812 targets of national security letters, 1,767 FISA orders, and 423 targets of FISA business records requests. In one notable section, a single 702 order reached nearly 90,000 targets. So, you know, NSA's trying to be more transparent. The director of National Intelligence said the report was part of a larger push for transparency within the agency, and it will continue to do so in the future. I guess that's a positive thing, but, I mean, the whole sort of purview of the NSA is not to be... That there are things that are secret, that are crucial to maintain security on the national security agency. So I don't expect that there is going to be a tremendous amount of openness from the NSA.
Yeah, I mean, transparency. It might be translucency.
Yes, a less opaqueness, even.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't expect that we're going to see a tremendous amount of transparency. But it's nice to have, you know, every little bit counts, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, anything you can get, especially given what Snowden revealed.
Yeah. I think it's time for them to start reforming. And this is part of that. All right, we're going to take one last break, and when we come back, Community is back, and its benefactor comes from the most unlikely place, and a breathtakingly beautiful drill down video of the week. So take a listen to this, and come on back.
Give me a hand, show me the door, I cannot stand to wait anymore. Somebody say, be what you be, we could be old and see, but I love you more than words can say. Well, I can't count the reasons I should stay. Give me some love, time and a dream.
You're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas. Yahoo has picked up on the ambitious meta-comedy community for its nascent video streaming site, Screen, after the show was canceled in May by NBC. I didn't even know that Yahoo Screen was a thing. Like,
Yahoo Screen is awesome. Are you kidding?
No, I've never heard of this service.
Screen is their curated playlist of visual stuff. Basically, they go and they find the – they have, like, access to all that stuff that's going on YouTube and on Saturday Night Live and a couple other bits of content. And they pull the hot stuff from the internet and they basically curate it for you.
Yeah. You know, the one great thing about this news, this article, was that it actually got me to research Yahoo Screen, find out, you know, that it was an actual thing. So Yahoo intends to keep everything the same, including executive producer Dan Harmon, and they're going to return this fall for a sixth season, consisting of...
I can't believe it's been out for that long. I guess it was kind of like the legacy, the post Office legacy with Parks and Recreation and so on.
Oh yeah. Well, they've had like this tremendous roller coaster ride of ratings and popularity. First season was ambitious and had showed the potential. And second season really sort of kicked it into high gear, and that's when everyone started following the show. But like Sony, the Sony Pictures Television, the company that produces Community, has had a notorious rocky relationship with Dan Harmon, the creator. Apparently, Dan Harmon is pretty difficult to get along with, and he's kind of a perfectionist. And so they essentially canned him for the fourth season of the series, and they brought in some new guys to do the show. And
we all know what happens when that occurs.
Yes,
you know, you can the main person, you bring in new guys, and then a season later, the show's off the air.
Yeah, well, that's the way it was looking. That's the way it was looking in the at the end of the fourth season. But they, through, I don't know what made Sony hang on to it, but they did hang on to it for one more season, and they brought Dan Harmon back in to EP the fifth season. And then, of course, at the end of that fifth season, they decided to finally can the show. And now yep. Yahoo's picked it up. Amazingly enough, it's like it's survived. It's like, you know, survived this this community has gone through, has had more lives than a cat, essentially. But I think the idea is that Yahoo is trying to become this sort of they're trying to become a site where people go to on a daily basis. They're trying to compete with something like Amazon Prime Video and Netflix. They're trying to become a destination site again, once again.
Yeah. I mean, they've been a portal for a very long time.
Yeah.
Right? Yahoo has been more about being... Yahoo's just really been more about being a destination for the purposes of allowing people to kind of go there and find their mail, their stocks, or this or that. The current age, the current entertainment age is about those things. Sure, information is important, but interesting, funny, quirky stuff is also important. So Community embodies that, interesting, funny, quirky. It's topical. It has all these things. And, you know, we heard how Microsoft may have tried to get Heroes back on target, the TV show from NBC. It's interesting that Yahoo is able to do this with Community, because Community has a very loyal following.
Absolutely.
I think in some ways much more loyal than Heroes did. And I think they'll be able to leverage that following in a kind of Veronica Mars way to get people showing up on Yahoo Screen. And I think those people are going to enjoy what they see. As a Yahoo Screen user,
I often see things that I wouldn't have normally found. You know, it's like reading a good blog. They're out there looking for, you know, getting access to all these random snippets of content around the web that you just aren't going to find yourself.
The content on Yahoo Screen, is there original content on Yahoo Screen, or is it all curated?
It's all curated, but it's basically the best of the web. Mm-hmm. Without them having to say that, and it's pretty good stuff. I really enjoy it, and I find it's a quick way for me to kind of be to keep in touch with what's going on in that aspect of the digital space, especially when it comes to comedy, which is something that I often struggle with finding. I tend to not enjoy comedy unless it's incredibly goofy. I mean, not goofy, geeky.
Right.
So Yahoo Screen allows me to find, you know, some value in what goes on SNL, you know, things like that.
The best part for me about this news is that this brings community one step closer to their online mantra, their six seasons in a movie, which is, you know, based on an in-joke in Community where one of the characters was a big fan of the Cape. Remember that show, that NBC show? And in the context of the show, he was certain that the Cape was going to go for six seasons in a movie. Of course, the Cape was canceled after one season. But Community,
should have been.
Yeah. Well, hey now. Hey. What the hell? Oh, it was fighting
words.
I was
trying to play that game that Bugs Bunny always
plays.
Oh,
fighting words.
You know, he's like, yes, you did. No, you didn't. Yes, you did. No, you didn't. No, you didn't. Yes, I did. I
almost fell for it, too. Oh. But ooh. Community may actually end up doing six seasons in a movie, so that's good. I would love to see that.
Speaking of content that has been removed from normal distribution and is now being put for digital distribution.
Yes.
I mean, it's been an amazing year. We've seen Veronica Mars return. We've seen a couple other things happen. Community is back. But for me, one of the best things around was reading Rainbow when I was a kid. And LeVar Burton, Star Trek fame, reading Rainbow, obviously Roots fame. He has rallied. He, you know, when it went out of style, I think in 2008, Reading Rainbow was canceled by PBS. The Onion did a great piece in LeVar Burton saying that he hated the show anyway, but that's not true. It's a great piece if you can find it. And LeVar Burton has come back with Reading Rainbow as a digital experience on the iPad. But in order to get the Reading Rainbow content to students and so on, he wanted to push it even farther than just people who own iPads. He wanted to get it into schools. He wanted to get it basically everywhere. And what he did was he started a Kickstarter. And he, with the money, is going to be able to produce Reading Rainbow content for schools around the country that they get for free. And it's obviously going to boost the ability for Reading Rainbow to create more content and have it live in these apps and online as a for-purchase, you know, pay-per-view service. So you want a book, you buy the book, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good deal when you think about the a lot of the junk that kids play with on iPads and the fact that you can turn on Reading Rainbow and they're going to read something and see the animation and hear LeVar Burton's voice. And in some ways, as a guy in his mid-30s who is, you know, about to get married on the path to have children. The idea of being able to pass this on, the way I was able to talk with, you know, my stepfather about the Hardy Boys, how we both liked them. The idea of being able to pass on not just the teaching of reading, but a love for reading in relatively the same paradigm, it might be on an iPad or a website or something and not on a traditional TV box, is kind of a big deal for me. So I backed the Reading Rainbow thing. On Kickstarter, it's had the most amount of backers ever. I think it's something like it's one of the biggest backers. You know, it's got $5.4 million. Not as big as Pebble, but still pretty damn big. But the amount of small donations was pretty impressive. I think it had more than 100,000 people giving money in order to get to that number. Which, if you contrast that with Pebble, it's a very different story. Pebble had hundreds. You know, it had like tens of thousands of people giving hundreds of dollars. So it has big impact, and a lot of people are interested and excited, and I'm interested and excited. And I just feel like what we have here between, you know, House of Cards, Veronica Mars. House of Cards is obviously a remake of the British original that aired on traditional TV. Community and what we're seeing here, it's a big deal that new media is able to capitalize on the fame of old media and bring it to us. So this is a trend that I hope to continue to see over time.
Me too. I think, you know, it's wonderful to me to think that the end of some of these intellectual properties isn't necessarily the end of their life, that they can find this new life in new forms and new methods of delivery and new mediums.
With the same people. You know, it's important that some of the same characters and actors and all these people get committed. It also shows an attachment between the production of the product and the players in the product. Right. It used to be that the actor was almost wholly divorced from the production process. They just showed up for work. They were their personality. You came to see them. But now between LeVar Burton and what's going on with Community and these things, the actors and so on, they're very much involved. They're very much a piece of the production. And I think that makes a stronger bond between the viewers, the content consumers, and the product. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's important because it used to be that as an actor, the only way to make it happen was to jump into as many roles as possible. You know, I'm going to be a Victorian, count. I'm going to be a no good smuggler. I'm going to do whatever, you know, like have all these breadth of roles. But I think it's important for an actor to invest in a role in order to make that bond with their community. Nathan Fillion having, you know, not being afraid of embracing his role as Mal in Firefly, despite other roles he may play, but saying, hey, look, I'm going to come to all the conventions. I'm going to do all this stuff because the relationship I have with you guys is as important as anything else. This kind of stuff is important. And I feel like when we see what's going on, when we see what's how these content properties last and how they change from medium to medium, a big part of it is those actors wanting to be on board and wanting to be committed. So reading Rainbow Back on the Air again, I mean, if you haven't seen it, it's really good, but you don't have to take my word for it.
All right, let's move on to our drill video. Down video of the week.
Dude, this video was great. I watched it and I was like, first of all, it's animation. And I'm a fan. Many people are, many people aren't. But what's great about this animation is that it's not today's run-of-the-mill computer animation. It was done by hand. It was done with, you know, some level of intimacy and love. And while there are a lot of people who worked on it, you can see the vision of an individual behind it, which is always pretty rare in today. So I really liked it. I wish it had gone on until there were old people and the dog was dead. I appreciated it for what it is.
So just to back up, so to explain what we're talking about here. So this is a short called Duet. And this is animated by Glenn Keane, who is a master animator. He is probably best well known as being the animator who animated Ariel in The Little Mermaid and The Beast in Beauty and the Beast. He worked
the greatest Disney movie of all time.
He's a Disney veteran of 30 years. And in the years since, he has left Disney, and Google hired him to collaborate on this project, this ATAP project. We've talked about this advanced technology and projects division of Google before, and what they're doing in particular at this ATAP, their ATAP division, is they're using... They're using a camera, handheld mobile camera devices to map out human areas and enhance navigation with handheld mobile devices. But part of that purview,
they're adding humanity to the typical navigation scheme.
Yes,
like how with songs they're adding humanity to the typical streaming music service scheme.
Right,
this is a trend. I'm seeing a trend here.
But part of that purview is that they need to sort of get more in touch with human movement, and computers just cannot do that alone. So they brought in Glenn Keane. To sort of consult with them about human movement and who and there's really no better study of human movement than Glenn Keane, with his decades of experience in classical animation. So together with the ATAP division, Glenn Keane collaborated on this short, which is features a young boy and a young girl as they grow up and play together. And there's a lot of great
and
movement
fall in love.
It. And fall in love.
Yeah.
Yes. And this,
I mean, it's 2014. How come it couldn't be a boy and a boy and a girl?
Well, this is.
I'm kidding.
It's another argument for another time, but I mean, for sure, this is I think the idea is that this particular animation is meant to be interactive within the ATAP environment, but the example that they're showing here is basically the flat 2D iteration of it. But there is apparently also going to be a version of this video that will be interactive on Android devices, that you can fire up your Android device and load up this this short and interact. I don't know if it's interacting with it with the characters themselves or interacting within the environment so that you can look around like a 3D perspective and see.
I want to be the dog.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure
the dog, it was having
anything
fun.
Is possible. The dog was great.
It was skateboard. It was doing a lot. I mean, visual stuff is visual, and it's great, and I really enjoyed it. I think the environment you're talking about has a lot of legs. I just feel like as a bit of kind of like animation, you know, not like Reading Rainbow, bringing it back.
Yeah.
Bringing it back to how it was when we were younger. It's a nice video of the week, and I think it's going to get a lot of play.
Yep.
And if it doesn't, it's just one of those kind of gems that
it is
that,
a gem,
you know, sitting on the internet.
So I've posted two links. One is to the individual short, which is about 3.5 minutes long, and the other is the making of, which is essentially an excerpt from the Google I/O keynote session that featured Glenn Keane's. What Google was doing with the ATAP division and featured Glenn Keane in the keynote session. So check that out. It's going to be in our show notes. And I think that brings this episode of the Drill Down to a close, with the exception of asking you, Dwayne, where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Oh, you can find me all over the place. You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, that's DWAYNED. You can find me on The Drill Down. Articles show up there from time to time with me. You can also check me out on DwayneDNYC.blogspot.com, which is where my blog sits. And then this week I've got a feature on VentureBeat.com. It's about organizing your big day from the little screen if you have iOS. And yeah, just look me up on VentureBeat.com.
Very cool.
That's where I am.
All right. I am at MrBabyMan.com. And if you Twitter and Facebook at MrBabyMan, you can also just Google MrBabyMan on the internet. It's my internet social handle. All my social links are there. As far as the show goes, if you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. We love your submissions. We love to publish them. You can let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. Get your product on our show. Be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.